Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Rebecca Struthers. She's a watchmaker and historian from Birmingham, England. She co-founded her workshop, Struthers Watchmakers, with her husband, Craig. And we're talking about her new book, Hands of Time, A Watchmaker's History. Rebecca, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
This book blew me away. This is one of those books that I had no idea what to expect. And I was just like amazed. And there are so many like sort of subplots that go throughout this book. But the amazing thing is this is not just a horological history, specifically of watches, but it's also a very personal history of you. And so it's like a memoir too.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite a complicated book to write for that reason. She's got the kind of the history and the technology and these incredible objects that have evolved with us over, well, on some level, thousands of years. But also that very kind of personal side of the journey with me being a watchmaker and sharing some of the stories of the incredible objects I've worked on myself. Kind of that process of how you learn to be a watchmaker or how you learn a craft.
That blew me away. We'll talk about that in a bit. But one of the things I want to say about this book is this book, besides having photographs, is illustrated by Craig.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So Craig is my husband, a fellow watchmaker, and a very good illustrator too.
He really is. Congratulations to Craig. Now, a little bit about your personal life. The thing I find hilarious is that originally you wanted to be a pathologist.
Yes, that's right.
What turned you away from pathology?
To be honest, I didn't really get the support I would have needed at school. I suppose that medical degrees are very expensive things to do, and that there was no family precedent to it, I suppose. And I remember one of my, one of my school careers advisors saying that to become a doctor, you really need to have parents who are doctors, so we don't think this is a career for you.
Oh, God.
That this isn't the people like you, Rebecca. I think, but ultimately, it's all worked out for the best in the end, as I love what I do. But it would have been a very different life, certainly.
The strange thing is, I kept seeing parallels between pathology and watchmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always.
Except on a much smaller scale and a tiny scale.
Yeah, completely. I've always been interested in anatomy and still am. And I think it's this kind of idea that the body is a machine and watches are machines. They're just different kinds of machines made out of different materials, but they both serve a purpose. They both have series of components that work together to do something for us. So it's just different kinds of machines.
You write about all the training that you needed to become a watchmaker, which absolutely turned me off to ever thinking about being a watchmaker. One of the things that, well, it seemed so intense. I think it was the first semester or the first year, what you do is just made your own tools.
Yeah, pretty much. that's really traditional way of learning any skill is to make your hand tools first. So that's the sort of way they would have taught apprentices centuries ago as well. So I was lucky to learn that way, but it is quite an intense start to your craft knowledge.
Well, what was sort of discouraging to me to read was that how much of these kinds of classes and these kinds of degree work are now passing by the wayside, that there's not the same classes that you took are not still being offered.
Yeah, it's a real shame. Watchmaking as a traditional artisan watchmaking is now a critically endangered skill in the UK, and clockmaking is also endangered too. So it is really hard, and I think so much of it was supported by universities that are now very driven by bringing in revenue,
obviously,
bring in a lot of money, and a lot of these vocational hand skills just don't, and we've not had the sort of places we would have needed to pick up tuition to keep turning out these numbers of makers, but then also we've had such a change in the industry with so much of being automated now. That it means we need less watchmakers than we used to, but then with that, the big brands don't want to finance people learning traditional watchmaking when all they need is people to do service centre work, and then ultimately, before you know it, you've lost all of those skills altogether. There's just not the support for it, even though there's still a great demand.
You have some wonderful descriptions of what it's like while you're working on a watch. You're so focused, and you're working so at such a small, tiny level of visualness. You know, you've got your loop on, and then you just sort of lose yourself in time, and no pun intended, while you're working on this watch. You write that, you know, your husband's working across from you, and it's not unusual for the two of you to have a day go by in at the workshop where you don't speak to each other.
Yeah, people ask how we get on as a couple and work together, and I think maybe that's part of the key.
It could be.
It is. It's just so focused, and you do kind of lose yourself into this microscopic world of this little object that's in front of you. And especially doing restoration, you don't see the same thing twice. Even if you've got the same caliber, the same mechanism in front of you, the person who's worn it will have worn it differently. So the wear patterns will be different. One might have had water damage, or another one has been badly serviced by someone in the past and needs more repairs. And you kind of, you start to read these stories into the objects that are in front of you. And it's such a, yeah, it's such a focused and intimate time. I mean, we literally work on a sheet of A4 paper. That's our background. So it's bright white to reflect the light. We can also make notes on it, but it's like the whole day is just spent in this A4 sheet of paper.
Now, you write that the invention of mechanical timekeepers has been as significant for human culture as the printing press. And when I read that in the start of the book, I went, oh, please. And then by the end of the book, I went, you're right. And you throughout the book, you make that case that to be able to keep time is incredibly important for our culture, for our cultures.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's completely sculpted our idea of what it means to be human. These creatures that live around a 24-hour circadian rhythm, and to do business, to work, to travel, to trade, medicine, obviously now greatly relies on knowledge of time and media. Radio, television, like all these things that we take for granted today, none of them would exist without us having developed the understanding of time that we have.
Now, let's talk about the earliest timepieces. And I should mention the study of watches and clocks as horology. Is that the whole study of time, too?
Yeah, so horology means the study of time.
Oh, my God.
I love that translation. But
so that could be physics, too.
Yeah, it does a little bit. I mean, even in watchmaking itself, you've got a lot of sort of physics, engineering, material science. But it generally, horology is referring to people who work with watches and clocks, although you get antiquarian horologists who study the history of it but don't do the making side. So there's little niches within it.
Now, the earliest known timepiece is 44,000 years old that we know of.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. So obviously something from 44,000 years ago doesn't have an instruction manual, unfortunately. It'd be wonderful.
So it's not going to show up at your shop, no.
Yeah, exactly. But, so it's the earliest contender that we have, and it's a carved piece of bone that has 29 notches spaced out with 30 spaces. So if you count between the two, the average is the lunar calendar of 29 and a half days. So that's potentially the earliest example that we have, and it also fits in with kind of the theory of how we develop this understanding of time through natural observation, and obviously lunar phases would have been something really obvious that our ancestors.
So Stonehenge, as you write in your book, Stonehenge is just a big timepiece.
Yes, pretty much. Following seasons, of course, as soon as we can start to keep track of months, we can start keeping track of seasons, which is the key to farming and agriculture, which is another huge cornerstone of the development of civilization itself.
And you go through in the book, and we don't have time to discuss any one of these because it'll take the rest of the interview, sundials, ampulletas, hourglass, water clocks. What I learned in that section, there were small sundials called ring dials that people wore?
Yes.
Did I understand that right? That sort of sounds like a joke that a person would have a sundial on the body.
No, you can even buy them today. You can buy replica ones, but you can carry them around with you. In fact, the earliest watches were not particularly accurate, to put it politely, to the extent that
not
some
surprised.
Of them had little sundials built into their case. So when they stopped telling the time, you could correct your watch to the position of the sun.
Now, the thing, you really touch all bases in this book. You actually write when the first TikTok occurred, and it was 1088. It was Susong in Henan, China, because it was the first ever escapement. And this brings up another thing about this book that's so great. The reader will learn a lot of watchmaker terminology. So what's an escapement?
Yeah, so the escapement is the part of the mechanism that's quite literally control the release of or escape of power. So that's why we call it an escapement. So you've got your power coming from your power source, which could be a spring. In Susong's clock, it was from water, and gravity pulling the weight of this water around a huge water wheel. And that would just spin out of control without something to control the escape of power. So the escapement just grabs and locks and then releases, a lock and release, check and release, the rotation of whatever that is running through from the power source. So that's the kind of TikTok. TikTok is literally the sound of the grab, release that goes on in pretty much every mechanical timepiece to this day.
Now, the Verge escapement made possible, as you write, church clocks, which were the big clocks that would appear in the center of a town.
Yes.
So that was the first time where everybody had a clock that they could look at.
Yeah, time is very much kind of a communal experience at this point. So not many people would have owned their own watches or clocks. So we would have shared our idea of time, and they were quite often placed in sort of marketplaces or churches to either bring us together for religious ceremonies and worship or for markets and trading. So it's very much, we didn't have our own time. We had this shared time as a community.
So if the clock was slow or fast, the whole community was slow or fast.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, this was long before the days of having our established GMT sort of time systems as well. So in the United States, there were hundreds of local time zones. So one village would have been operating on a different time to the next village along, let alone a village on the other side of the continent.
Oh, my God. When did the word clock come about?
So the word clock originates from the word clocker or cloche, which means bell. So it's Latin and French it's derived from. And that's because the earliest clocks were just a bell. There was no dial. So you'd have had to wait around for the bell to ring to tell you what time of day it was. This, again, is something that's evolved our idea of being able to look at our phone or our watch and know the correct time to within the second, is relatively recent. As for a lot of our existence as a society, even after the advent of the first clocks, we were accurate to within minutes, sometimes within an hour.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Rebecca Struthers. She's a watchmaker and historian from Birmingham, England. She co-founded her workshop, Struthers Watchmakers, with her husband, Craig. And we're talking about her wonderful new book, Hands of Time, A Watchmaker's History. You write that astronomers drove clocks to greater accuracy. Why is that?
Oh, this is where science really starts to play an important point in the development of timekeepers. Because when you're using something like, say, a sundial, our solar hour is going to vary slightly because we have longer days in the summer and shorter days in the winter, or vice versa. So if you want to make a scientific observation of something, you need to create a uniform hour, uniform time increments. And there's little better, or at that time certainly, than a machine to do that for you. A machine and the gearing of the teeth, so the number of teeth on each wheel, will define this set increment again and again and again. And astronomy was hugely important at this point, and astronomers needed some way of regularly being able to tell uniform time to make their observations. So the two were intrinsically linked.
Yeah, people like Christian Huygens from the Netherlands, right, was a person who made discoveries both in design of timepieces, but also in astronomy.
Yeah, there's a huge overlap. A huge, huge overlap. And a lot of the people sort of commissioning these early timekeepers as well, they're very expensive. So it was only the wealthiest in society who could have afforded their own personal clocks and watches. And there was a great belief in the power of although it was astrology at that point, and you get kind of astronomy as a servant to astrology rather than the other way around, to understand what was going on in the heavens to help inform their daily lives. So you get these people commissioning these vastly expensive and elaborate clocks. Some of them would have celestial displays.
Oh, and some of them, as you describe them in the book, are amazing. They do everything.
Yeah.
Oh, my
they're
God.
Incredible works of art. But the two is so, they're so closely linked to each other. They're barely inseparable at first.
But that also brings up the fact, as you write, the clocks originally were status symbols, that it's the rich and the powerful that have clocks in their homes.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got kind of clocks existing as a way to help us, so help us divide our day, to help us understand kind of the decisions we're making, as I mentioned, with astrology and astronomy. But they're also a display of our wealth and our knowledge, because, you know, you must have a certain amount of capital available to be able to buy one in the first place. And then to understand how this newfangled work of engineering, you must be very educated as well. So they were, for that reason, very much status symbols. And then obviously now with fashion as well, today, they can tell people about our fashion, our tastes, our styles, whether or not you get something cheap and cheerful or a famous name, or if you get something that's really expensive, but a name that only expert collectors will have heard of. It's our way of telling people about who we are.
Then watches are finally developed. The first one, I think, was by Peter Henlein. But some of these early watches that you describe are just amazing. There was one that had it was set in a Colombian emerald.
Yes, in the Cheapside Hoard. That was found buried in the basement of a building in Cheapside in London.
Wow.
And it's believed to be kind of the stash itself is Jacobean and Elizabethan. So this watch would have been made towards the end of the 16th century, but it was carved into a solid piece of emerald. So the actual case itself, like a little pocket watch, about the size of a small Satsuma, so it's quite little too. The belly of the pocket watch case itself is solid emerald, and so is the cover that sits over the top of it. And it's an incredible looking thing. Easy skill to make.
There's so many amazing digressions in this book or connections that you make. One is how the rise of Reformed Protestantism changed the nature of the watch.
Yeah, so this is
I never saw that coming.
<It's> like... Well, we can track so much with the work of craftspeople and artisans, and you see this very much throughout throughout the Reformation, Calvinism, and the persecution of Huguenots in France, and these who included a number of incredibly skilled artisans, not just in watchmaking but in jewelry, silversmithing, ceramics, and so on. And you see them spread out across Europe, and these new centres of these crafts start to appear. So it was Huguenot watchmakers moving over to London that played a huge role in seeing London become one of the epicentre of watchmaking at one point during the 18th and 19th centuries.
Now, there's so much we can talk about, but I think I want to talk about watches and the calculation of longitude. First of all, there was a naval tragedy, the Scilly Isles naval tragedy.
Yes.
And that started, that made people, there was the Longitude Act, which had a 20,000 pound prize for somebody to develop a timepiece that would be accurate enough to measure longitude.
Yeah, so the Longitude Prize was just to find a solution for calculating longitude at sea. So, as you can imagine, if you're out of sight of land, you're out in the open ocean, it's very hard to figure out exactly where we are in the world. And it's much more straightforward to calculate our north and south position, so how far above or below the equator we are, by the position of the sun. But longitude, which is your east-west position, is much more challenging. And, of course, if you get that wrong by even a few degrees, it could make the difference between life or death, between hitting a reef or making it safely, as happened with the naval disaster that started all of this. So there were many kind of ideas tabled. A lot of people felt that it would be a celestial observation that would crack the challenge. But in the end, it was John Harrison and his marine timekeepers that did it. So
it was a, I think it was it was H4? Was that the name of the piece?
H4, yeah, that was the one to finally succeed, which was incredible. It took the watch from being something that was seen as just a decadent bauble by this point, not particularly accurate, not particularly reliable, to a real scientific instrument of something of great importance. It demonstrated how accurate they could be. And that would ultimately, go on to change again our relationship with timekeepers.
Again, you have so much interesting information. Sort of, you talk about how these timepieces were kept aboard ship, and this is one of those things. It would sound like I would do. People would lock it in a wooden box, and then they would go to take it up. And first of all, the box may have warped, and they could no longer open it up, or they lost the keys. To open the box? How embarrassing.
Getting off the ship with a key. There's another one. Someone getting off with the keys and they set off for sail. They were challenging to work with at first and still hugely expensive. So a lot of people still rely on pocket watches. But I also mentioned cats.
Trim the cat.
Trim the cat, who took a fancy for nautical astronomy. Because cats were known to occasionally break ships' timekeepers as well by playing with them. And you can just, I think anyone who has a cat, I have two.
Oh, yeah, I have two too.
you know what, like, curiosity killed the watch in the case of several cats.
Now, there's a lot to talk. In the last few minutes, I want to talk about John Wilter and Verge watches. You came across this watch, and there was a signature in there, John Wilter, and you'd never heard of the person before. You research it and come to find out it's just a made-up name, but it has to do with these quickly made, mass-produced watches.
Yeah, this is the beginning of what turned out to be an obsession that kind of 15 years on, I'm still still studying them and still absolutely obsessed by them. So this is a kind of forgery. It was made towards the end of the 18th century with a pocket watch. But they were made with names that we believe don't exist. There's no evidence of watchmakers being working under those names. And they were signed as being London, despite the fact that there was no evidence that they were being made in London. They're certainly very stylistically different to what we'd expect from a London watch. And I just became obsessed with finding out who John Wilter was. And this journey took me back to 250 years in time and across Europe, following physical examples of these watches. And I was very lucky to work with the British Museum to study surviving examples and take them apart and subject them, ironically, to forensic analysis after my pathology jaunt as a kid. But to study them for hidden marks and messages and meanings, to find out who was really making them, where and why. And ultimately, it kind of turns into the story of how the emergence of very early non-standardized mass production came out of fake watches.
It meant that the average person could own a watch.
Yeah, it was the first step in that journey. So the journey wasn't completed and perfected until full standardized mass production, which was very much an American invention. So that was Ingersoll and the dollar watch. And that was sort of 100 years later. And we were able to make and retail the watch for the same as an average worker's day's wage, which was a dollar at the time.
Well, it was amazing because the people who were making these actually set up assembly lines, which is not how watchmakers typically worked.
Yeah, it was all cottage industries, really, until that point. So you get collectives of artisans living and working in close proximity to each other, but kind of really specialist jobs would be outsourced and people would be working in small numbers, generally speaking. But by in-housing everything and creating these production lines of work, we went from the busiest London workshops at the time that could make a few thousand watches a year up to these manufacturers, ironically now in Switzerland, that can make tens of thousands of watches a year.
We only have a few minutes left, and I have to mention this person because obviously he's a hero of yours, and that's Abraham Louis
Breguet, yes.
That person sounds, when I came across that section and your references to him, he definitely sounds like a horologist's hero.
Yeah, absolutely. He's such a fascinating character. And I really realized as I was writing this book how little we know about him as a person. His watches are so famous. You know, anyone who knows that watches, as soon as you get to a certain point, you're going to come across Abraham Louis Breguet, because, you know, he was working or joined the French Revolution, Napoleonic Wars. So this is towards the end of an early 19th century, at the start of the 19th century. And yet he has more inventions still in use in watches to this day than any other watchmaker. So things like shock settings, for example, if you see a watch being shock set, the early development of that shock setting was by Breguet. Wow. Automatic watches that self-wind with the movement of our wrist, that was Breguet. So all of these inventions wow. still going, but a truly fascinating character as well that worked through such an incredible period of history.
Well, the terror, and as a matter of fact, Jean-Paul Marat helped him escape at one point, and then he helped Jean-Paul Marat escape once, and then Marat did around and did the same deed for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
What an incredible character.
At one point. Yeah.
I can't imagine making watches during the terror.
He did. This was the incredible thing he carried on making. And then he briefly had to go to Switzerland, obviously, for the sake of keeping his head. So he'd worked for the French aristocracy before, and ironically for French and English, and would then go on to return to Paris to work for Napoleon, who it said would dress up in disguise to visit his workshops. He was so obsessed with Breguet's work. But Breguet watches were also owned by the Duke of Wellington.
Wow.
So he was so incredible. He was working for all sides, and people just accepted it because of how amazing his work was. It's, truly, truly fascinating.
There's so much more in this book, including a complete guide of how to repair a watch. Well, not how you will repair a watch, how Rebecca repairs a watch, because you're not going to do it because it's too detailed to work. My guest tonight is Rebecca Struthers. She's a watchmaker and historian from Birmingham, England. She co-founded her workshop, Struthers Watchmakers, with her husband, Craig. And we've been talking about her book. It's just endlessly fascinating. Hands of Time, A Watchmaker's History. Rebecca, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much again for having me.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.